This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 16 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're joined by Chrissy from Educating Geeks. How's it going, Chrissy?
It's going great. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome aboard.
Yeah. So you do Educating Geeks, which I know a lot of people on the network are familiar with because, you know, there's a strong Educating Geeks presence on the 602 Club and whatnot. But specifically, what do you do on the show?
Well, I like to contribute where I can and jump in on stuff that I'm super interested in. I like to think that I provide the coming up with silly jokes. That's usually my contribution is like, did you notice this funny, silly thing? And then everybody's like, oh, Chrissy, that's not what happened at all. But I really like classic movies and being introduced to new geeky things as well.
Cool.
Awesome. Well,
silly jokes are always needed on podcasts.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what about Star Trek? Are you a fan?
I am a fan. I'm definitely not like on the level of a super fan who like really knows everything, but I am a fan. I really love everything that I've seen. I particularly love the original series. I love me some William Shatner and all of that fun. I've seen all the movies and I love them a lot. And I particularly love the new J.J. Abrams movie and Into Darkness. So good. I love it so much.
Me too. You know, I mean, everyone
the
else.
The production
is like,
quality oh, wasn't darkness. At fault mm-hmm. with that movie,
mm-hmm. but, hey. Mm-hmm. but yeah, no, I mean, mm-hmm. I think that Star Trek 09 is like the best Star Trek thing ever, and you know, Into Darkness is pretty high up there too. So you're looking forward to the new movie Star Trek Beyond?
Oh yes, I saw the preview when it came out online, and I was just like, I'm psyched. I've seen some people. You know, nitpicking things here and there, but I'm psyched. I loved it. I thought it looked super exciting.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you say you're not a big fan of Star Trek, but you've seen the animated series. I mean,
I have seen all of the animated series. I have.
That's more dedicated than most hardcore fans. I'm going to point that out.
I own an improv comedy theater called National Comedy Theater, and through that and Phoenix Comic Con, we have done several panels where we watch the animated series and sort of pick apart the episodes and talk about how they're just bonkers a lot of the
time.
It's
a crazy show. It's a crazy show, right? I mean, what, they do like a... I mean, they meet the devil in one episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's great. It's great. They've got the one where the giant slugs are keeping them captive in the zoo and everything. It's good stuff.
And it's that old school animation that also brings something sort of special and strange to the table, where everybody's eyeballs are like just the same as their flesh tone, mysteriously.
Yeah, it looks like Scooby Doo animation, basically.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And that's what I miss about it. Like I miss that animation style. I truly do. If they were to make another Star Trek series that's not live action, I would want them to ape that style because I just think it's fun.
And that's the thing. Everyone's always like, you know, the stories were really good. If they were to like redo the animation as like CGI, then that'd be something really great. And I'm always like, you are freaking insane. No, I want to see like a C-Lab kind of thing where they take that animation and do new, better stories than whatever.
I'm with you
to
guys.
Each his own. So. We're talking about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation today, which is the final film that J.J. Abrams produced for someone else as of right now for another month or less than a month. But before we get into Mission Impossible Rogue Nation in particular, Chrissy, what are your thoughts on Mission Impossible as a whole? Because I hear you're a really big fan.
I am a big fan, and I love it. I'm the girl who walks around and just like, you haven't seen Mission Impossible Rogue Nation? Let's stop what we're doing and let's just take a moment. Let me share this with you so that your life can be better from here on out. I love it. Of course, I'm a fan of the genre in general, but I just think Mission Impossible has something so special about it. I'm a big fan of always finding that lesson in movies where it's like, hey, you know, never give up. Just keep on trying. And that's the Mission Impossible mantra right there is impossible doesn't exist. There's always a way as long as you're willing to, you know, as long as you have really great core strength and you're willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done. Plus, I think that Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation both had lots of elements of comedy to them. So it's not just 100% action, you know, hitting all the time. There's also really great moments of levity and comedy and visual humor that just elevate the whole thing, in my opinion. And I'm a particular fan of Tom Cruise.
Awesome.
Who's not? You know, before we go forward,
I just want to get your opinion on Last Samurai and its greatness. Yes?
Last Samurai. All right. Well, here's the thing. They can't all be gems. If you're going to be as prolific as Tom Cruise.
This did not go the way I imagined. Let's go back to Rogue Nation. Let's go back to Rogue Nation.
That's exactly what I was saying last week, is Last Samurai is a piece of crap. It's a piece of crap. It's really, really long and really, really boring and really, who cares? Although he's working with that director again. What's his name? Marshall Herskovitz or whatever. He's directing the new Jack Reacher movie for him now. So
really, yeah. Okay, that is super intriguing to me. I'm not sure good or bad, but I'm in. I will go see that movie. And I just think Tom Cruise as a person also is super interesting. Like, he gets a lot of flack, as you guys have pointed out, mm-hmm. For being an unusual sort of fella. But I think that he's, you know, super intense. Yes, obviously. But I think he's intense in a really, like, positive way, you know.
Yeah.
And for better or worse, you know, if the guy wants to hang on the side of an airplane, as impractical as that might be, he's going to make it happen. You know, whatever the obstacles are that are in the way, you know, he's going to figure out a way to overcome them and do what he sets his mind to do. And I think we could all admire that a little bit.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Everyone you hear talk about him say he's a super nice guy, like the nicest guy in the world. And he makes some awesome movies. I just saw Jerry Maguire on the big screen a few weeks ago. That movie is so good. He's so good in that movie. I mean, yeah. And then there's Magnolia. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
What a performance.
And Top Gun, man. Top Gun.
Top Gun. That's true. Yeah.
The way you feel about Last Samurai, the way I feel about Top Gun.
Really?
Yeah. But anyway.
So, okay, so then finally, what do you think about J.J. Abrams? I know you said you liked the new Star Trek movies. You're a fan of his other work in general? Or?
I am, yes. And for a while, I feel like I was, like, enjoying his work without knowing that he was, you know, the man behind the curtain responsible for it all. But the more I hear about things that he has been involved with, the more I'm like, yeah, loved it. His body of work is impressive. And now, you know, these days, if I see his name attached, if I see Bad Robot attached, I'm going to check it out. And because I think there's a better than average chance that it's going to be something that's impressive and worth my time.
Excellent. Cool. Excellent. All right. So let's get into Mission Impossible Rogue Nation here. Okay, this is a movie which came out just this past summer. It is written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, who is probably best known as the Oscar-winning writer of The Usual Suspects, but he's written a million other things. Apparently, he even did an uncredited rewrite on Rogue One, the new Star Wars movie, which will be out this Christmas.
I did not know that.
That's the word on the street. It hasn't been officially confirmed, but people are saying that he quote unquote saved the movie. So who knows?
Wow.
He's also, in my opinion, a really, really good director, having only directed two movies prior to this, Jack Reacher, which we were talking about before. And before that, years and years before that, the Way of the Gun. Have you guys,
which I love.
Yeah.
So good.
Have you seen it, John?
Never seen it. Always wanted to. Never seen it.
You got to see it. It's awesome. Yeah.
All right.
It's pretty great.
So he's in, you know, Tom Cruise seems to like working with people who he's worked with before. So, you know, Christopher McQuarrie, having directed Jack Reacher, he, you know, got the gig for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. The story was co-written by McQuarrie and Drew Pierce, who was the co-writer on Iron Man 3. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, John, would you want to give a synopsis of this thing?
Yes. It's the fifth Mission Impossible movie, and Mission Impossibly things happen. And there's a big bad guy, and they beat him.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. Yeah, sorry about that. No, I, you know, honestly, it is, you know, it's what you, I guess, would you've come to expect from a Mission Impossible movie, which is it's a continent traversing super plot of bad guys that are trying to bring about, you know, the destruction of the world as we know it. And there's only one group of people that can stop them, and they've been disavowed by the government, and they have to stop them, even though they won't get the credit for it or something.
The disavowing thing, I mean, we talked about that last week.
Yeah. But
it would be great just once to see one of these movies where they're actually just like, you guys are good at your job. We need you to go in and do something. But
right.
where they're avowed. You guys are avowed. Yeah. Go for it. Get out there. Right. Do your thing.
Yep. Yep. Maybe next
the
time.
The full resources of the IMF is at your disposal. Let us know if you need anything.
But I mean, imagine that, like how good they do without the full resources of the IMF. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, they don't have to. They can use their main credit card instead of the backup card to get around. It'd be pretty awesome.
I mean, they could.
They can submit their receipts later for reimbursement.
Right. Right, the Vienna tickets get reimbursed next time.
I mean, if they have all those resources, then like at some point they have to go to space, right? Because I mean, they can, right?
Well, yeah, the moon base that's up there.
That would be awesome. I'd love to see them.
I would love to see Mission Impossible do a like a Moonraker riff. That'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good.
Ooh, wait a minute. Yes.
So, Chrissy, what did you think about Rogue Nation?
I loved it. I really loved it. I enjoyed it a lot. I saw it twice in the theater and like ran out on the day it came out on DVD and bought my DVD Blu-ray copy so I could really irritate my husband by watching it again at least two more times. I loved it. I thought Ghost Protocol was amazing. I thought Rogue Nation was just as good. It would be hard for me to decide which one I like better. But I think there's a lot happening in Rogue Nation that is exciting and easy to get behind, easy to love.
Where do you think it ranks amongst the other Mission Impossible movies?
I'm particularly fond of Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation. Of course, Mission Impossible 3, that was great. Mission Impossible 2 sort of lost me a little bit. Like,
yes.
Maybe there's too much Dove happening.
That is the correct opinion.
Around.
Too much Dove.
That is the absolute correct opinion to have. Yes.
Nope. And, yeah. You know, Mission Impossible 1 was kind of a let's get the band together sort of thing. So I think to me, Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation are kind of tied, depending on the day, one or the other is my favorite. And I think it was because they had that extra little edge of being sort of funny and sort of cheeky and a little bit sassier and more self-aware than maybe the first two.
Yeah, it's strange because, I mean, now you kind of think of that as being just sort of like a staple of the franchise, you know? I mean, you think of like Simon Pegg as sort of like the standard comic relief. And they even sort of get away from that in Rogue Nation. But, yeah, when you think about, you know, especially those first two movies, there really isn't that. I mean, occasionally they tell jokes and occasionally they're funny. Not always. But it's always this dry humor, like, you know, mm-hmm. Anthony Hopkins saying, this is Mission Impossible, not Mission Difficult. You know, difficult should be a walk in the park or whatever it was, you know. And it's like, it's one of those things where you're just like, oh, yeah, yeah you're right. But I mean, like these other movies, you know, you got Simon Pegg, you know, doing this stuff and or Jeremy Renner or whoever. And just the way that everyone's playing off of each other, it's like legitimately funny. So
And Alec Baldwin as well is another actor. You know, I think you've got a laundry list of actors who are great at drama, great at action, but then also are skilled comedians. You know, we've seen over and over lots of times in the different roles that they've taken on. So they understand both sides of the coin, action, drama, and comedy. They're equally skilled across the board. So I think it makes it possible for those funny moments to have a bit of a stronger ring than your Anthony Hopkins giving you a bit of wit.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But here's my question, though, because I've had this hypothesis for years now. You know, I'm under the belief that any role that Alec Baldwin gets should go to William Shatner. Do you think that that holds up here? Do you think William Shatner in this role would be a superior bit of casting?
Let me. I need to take a moment and like picture Shatner in 30 Rock and see what that looks like in my mind's eye. And I think it holds up. I would love to see Shatner in that role. Absolutely. But I think Baldwin was also good.
He's good for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I'll take a. I think, though, that, you know, Baldwin, in this, he comes to it, like, he's coming to it from that, like, sort of, I'm an action guy. You know, look at my haircut and my eyebrows as I raise them menacingly at you and use this voice to convince you. So that's where we start with him, and then we sort of get the moments of comedy towards the end. I think with Shatner, it would have been, it would have been like, oh, look, it's William Shatner! I'm so excited to be seeing him! So... I do like that as a theory, though. I'm a fan of your theory, definitely.
I think Shatner would have worked. Yeah.
Yeah.
He definitely would have worked, but I think Baldwin, and I say this with utmost respect to Mr. Shatner, Baldwin may be with us for a few more recurring appearances.
And that could be, but you know, then again, that, it's Mission Impossible, so, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I could easily see, like Chrissy, to agree with you, I think that the more comedic stuff, I definitely could have seen Shatner tackling, but I think the hearing stuff, like Baldwin carries enough of that sort of the same weight that he had in the famous ABC scene from Glengarry Glen Ross. He can bring that weight to it and, you know, oh, this guy is such a dick. And then, you know, you move forward and then you can still buy that he's funny and he's lightened up. So yeah.
Baldwin has that line at the one of the final scenes where he says something along the lines of, Ethan Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny and he has set his sights on you. Yeah. And that line is a little bit cheesy and, and kind of corny. So I don't know. It's like you said, if he didn't bring that like Alec Baldwin weight to it, like I believe Alec Baldwin would make those sort of giant pronouncements, probably just going about his everyday life.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to hear a Shatner take on that line reading in particular.
That would be great. Yeah. That'd be great. I mean, the other thing that Baldwin brings to it in sort of a meta way is, you know, he was Jack Ryan, you know, he's got that history, and it's like, here he is, you know, at a different point in his career and everything, and now he's the boss of, you know, the new Jack Ryan in a sense, which I don't know, maybe that's a little cute or maybe it's unintentional, but either way, I like it, you know, it's cool.
It works.
Well, what about you, John? You hadn't seen the movie up until now, so what did you think about it?
I had not seen the movie up until now, and I can honestly say that this is one of those rare movie experiences where when I miss it in the theater and I see it, you know, when I rent it, I so thoroughly regretted from beginning to finish not seeing it in the movie theater, especially the stuff that I know were IMAX sequences. Like, I could kick myself because I have a legit IMAX theater within driving distance of my house, and I didn't go see it. I will never make that mistake again. I loved this from beginning to finish. I actually give the edge to this over Ghost Protocol because, in specific, I feel more that he outsmarted the villain at the end as opposed to just bludgeoning him into submission. And that's the type of thing I like to see that actually, for me, harkens more back to the original Mission Impossible movie, where it felt like he was using his brain as well as his brawn. In terms of the action sequences, I honestly feel like, having seen Ghost Protocol very shortly before this, that Ghost Protocol, they had fun with it and they had nice big action sequences. And I feel almost like somebody walked in to the pre-production meetings for this movie and said, that's what we did. We need to go bigger. We need to make this insane. And I think that they went crazy insane in the right places, and they just delivered. Like, I can't praise this one enough. I think I have to go back and rewatch the original, but right now this one stands at the top of the heap. I think that they just enjoyed it so much that even when I saw him spill off the motorcycle in that scene, I didn't go, well, every bone in his body is broken and he's probably lost 80% of his skin and he wasn't even wearing a helmet and he should, be convalescing somewhere. I went, yeah, okay, fine, whatever.
Like, and also, he was dead like 20 minutes before that.
Yeah, it's true.
He's a resilient chap. He really is. Yeah.
I mean, I think I went into this last week, but, I've always been a huge fan of this franchise from the very beginning. And it's one of those things where I always really look forward to the next Mission Impossible movie. I'm always super excited about it, at the beginning, because it was like the first blockbuster at the summer, then the first blockbuster that I showed as a projectionist. And then, there's always been this anticipation. I mean, this was the movie out of all the movies that came out last summer that I was looking forward to the most, for sure. And especially since, I love Christopher McQuarrie and I love, Way of the Gun and everything. And when I saw it, I saw it, in the theater, and my initial reaction was like, yeah, that's good, but it does not compare to the other ones. Like, this may be the worst of all of them, even though I still think it is a very good movie. You know, it just didn't connect with me on some level, which is strange. But rewatching it again this week, it worked a lot more than it did, the first time around. I still don't think it's as good as 3 or 4 at all. And I don't know. I mean, yes, I guess if you were to do the math, it is a better movie than 2. Although there's something about 2 which just holds this weird place in my heart. So, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it does really work. And like the motorcycle chase, for example, I thought was fantastic. I mean, that's one of the best sequences, yep, in I think any of these movies. And like you're saying, the writing I think is very, very good. Maybe better than most. I mean, I don't know, it's hard because like 3 has a lot of like logic gaps and stuff like that, and there's some things about it which don't really work when you put it all together. But I think it really works on sort of a thematic level. I don't know. I definitely think that 3 is the best. So I don't know whether or not you could consider 3 to be the best written, or I could consider 3 to be the best written of the series, but this is definitely close to that. And yeah, I mean, there's things about it which I like, things about it which I didn't really work for me as well. But, watching it again now, I definitely liked it a lot more. And I had this weird thing where after I finished it, I had this overwhelming desire to, like, go back and watch specific sequences over again just because I wanted to sort of, like, relive those moments. So, yeah, I definitely think it's a good movie, I don't know exactly where I would put it in the overall franchise, but somewhere in there.
But what is it that didn't work? What keeps it from rising above or specifically equal to 3 or 4 with you? What is it that doesn't quite click?
Well, it's interesting because I think like 3 and 4 work for different reasons. 3, I mean, one of the things that I really connected to with that was the relationship, between him and his wife and all that stuff. I thought that that was really good. I thought the team dynamic was really solid in that one. And I also just love the direction in that movie. I mean, J.J. Abrams, I think that he's like one of the absolute top directors in the world, and I love his style. I absolutely love it. With Four, I feel like it was much more sure of itself on sort of an aesthetic level. It had you could tell like the planning and the choreography and everything which was involved in creating these sequences was like so well thought out that it, you know, the sequences played in this sort of almost, you know, rhythmic, you know, musical, mm-hmm. you know, fashion, which I really appreciated, sort of like seeing how they put all this stuff together in a very specific way. With this one, I feel like while some of the sequences, like for example, the motorcycle chase, may be better than some of the sequences in Ghost Protocol, I think it intentionally has a much rougher quality to it. It's very sort of like edgy and sort of down, you know, down and dirty, you know, grounded mm-hmm. Storytelling, you know, and I mean, that's one of the things that I love about this series is each one feels different, you know, and I don't know, maybe I just responded better mm-hmm. to those other two aesthetics than I did to this one, but I still think it works really well.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough. I thought that the Scientology reference might have thrown you off.
I didn't see that.
The record in the beginning that he gets his fake mission from uh-huh. is straight out of Battlefield Earth, the book. That is
really?
How they impart the information to Johnny Goodboy. I know because I read that book and I saw that atrocious movie. Book way better than the movie. Ending still stinks, but the book's way better. But yeah, that's how they train Johnny Goodboy Tyler, is they have these giant records that they put on a turntable and like goes into his brain and like projects out and stuff like that. And as soon as he put it on there, I was like, wow, you sly devil, you got a Battlefield Earth reference in here.
Nice.
So I can only hope he put it in there as a dig at Travolta for screwing up Battlefield Earth so badly.
I'm sure that's probably what it was.
I imagine there's probably some Scientology infighting that happens from time to time.
I guess we'll never know.
I won't.
So, okay, what did you guys think about Christopher McQuarrie's direction? Because, I mean, like, I guess, like we were just saying, it is very different from the others in the series. Chrissy, what did you think about it? You said you're a fan of Way of the Gun, right?
I am a fan of Way of the Gun. I like Way of the Gun a lot, and I like a lot of the movies that he's written, too. So it's cool to see him directing a movie, you know, without a lot of movies to look back to and be like, well, this is a signature Christopher McQuarrie move here. And I thought there were a lot of moments in Rogue Nation that were just like really visually like interesting. So for example, when he is in the big underwater spinning computer lab, and he's finally running out of oxygen, just the shot of like, you see Ethan's hands like release the handle and like this door slowly drifts away from him. And I thought that was really interesting way to frame the shot and way to sort of give us that information, and lots of other like just fun visual shots that he went with, which were almost themselves jokes, like in the big car chase where they end up window to window, side by side with Jeremy Renner and Bing Rhames. So
it's
a funny visual joke. And then when the car finally crashes and they're on the ground, you see the feet and legs of one of the motorcycle villains approaching, and then pow, he's hit by a car. I think that Christopher McQuarrie has a great way of showing the audience what he wants them to see in a way that gives the information, with having to use dialogue to tell the audience what they should be seeing and thinking and feeling, which is good storytelling, good filmmaking, in my opinion. But it also gives you those moments of visual comedy in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of interesting that he would be so visual, considering the fact that his background really is primarily in writing and not so much in, you know, direction. But yeah, that is interesting. True.
Well, the movies that he's written too are, although he's responsible for the words, I guess, a lot of those movies require the visuals to be there in order for you to get the story, like The Usual Suspects or Edge of Tomorrow and things of that nature. And I remember Way of the Gun being one of the things I liked about it, being very much there was a lot of moments of silence between the characters where they were just like acting to tell us what was happening between them. So I think that Rogue Nation had that as well.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, to speak to your point about like knowing how and when to show the audience, you know, the information visually, one of the things that really jumped out to me that I really liked a lot is in the end when, and you'll forgive me that I can't recall the character names off the top of my head, but when she is being pursued by the Bone Doctor, and, you know, he's going through that beautiful set piece with the columns and everything, and she's moving around. There's no quick visual gag of him popping out from behind a column or anything like that. It's a truly tense moment because she has the initiative, because she's gotten around him, and it's just really tense when she's sneaking up behind him. It feels so real and so believable that, you know, it would play out like this, that it's not a cheap thrill. It's a true build of suspense to the inevitable fight that's going to happen between them. It doesn't cheat its way there. It builds to it.
Yeah, I guess for me, when I first heard that McQuarrie was directing, I was super excited because, you know, he is so good. But the thing that I kept on thinking about was how Way of the Gun, which is a very action-packed movie, the way that it goes about its action, which is like to do it in the most realistic way possible. Like, you know, I heard that, you know, there's the whole thing where they're like trying to get this ransom. It's like, what, $30 million or something like that. And they actually like measured it out and figured out like what that would be in terms of how many bags, you know, how many duffel bags filled with cash, you know, and everything. And, and you know, all of the sort of like military tactics which are used in the gun battles and stuff like that are all sound and everything. And speaking of sound, all of the gunshots actually sound like real gunshots and everything. And I sort of loved the idea of like a guy who, you know, goes through that much effort to make action realistic doing a Mission Impossible movie, which is usually the most out there, crazy, insane, unrealistic action you'll ever see, you know? And, well, it was certainly more out there than I would have, I guess, hoped for, you know? Not that I'm against that in general, but I kind of wanted to see that unique quality that McQuarrie would bring to it. I definitely think it is more grounded than the other movies, you know, like we were talking about. I mean, something that we talked about a lot last week was Robert Elswit's photography, you know, in Ghost Protocol. He photographed this movie as well. And one of the things which struck me, you know, right away, as soon as, you know, the movie started up this time, is it looks completely different from the last movie. You know, it's much grainier and there's a lot more handheld stuff and it's like got sort of these golden hues to it and everything. And I mean, it really kind of speaks to what it is the director brings to the visual style, especially when you've got a cinematographer like Elswit, who we were talking about last week, is, you know, very sort of malleable and does whatever the director needs him to do. And I think that was pretty cool. And I mean, the fact, I don't know, I'm kind of obsessed with grain structure for some reason, but whatever. I know it's a weird thing to be obsessed
Nothing
with.
Nothing is surprising anymore, Mike. Nothing is surprising anymore.
But seeing the grain structure in this movie, I was like, wow, that's so cool. You know, they were trying to make this thing much more realistic and much more grounded. And I think because of that, things like the motorcycle chase, which you can compare to the motorcycle chase in Mission Impossible 2, maybe works better, maybe not, maybe works better, because it is so much more realistic, maybe. So much more visceral and everything. And I really did like his direction quite a bit. I thought it was pretty awesome. Okay. So now here's the big question. Okay. Big question for me. Maybe not a big question for anyone else, but Mission Impossible as a franchise, 5 movies, 5 different directors, no director trying to mimic what the director before him did or anything like that. 5 unique visions of this franchise, of this character. I mean, you could almost say, like, up until number 3 that, you know, Tom Cruise is playing a different character in those first 3 movies. You might as well, you know, there's nothing to suggest that it is the same character aside from his name and his job. So now, Mission Impossible 5. Everyone loves it. We're all in agreement that it's awesome. You two think that it may be the best of the franchise. They've announced that Mission Impossible 6 will be made, of course, and that it will be written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie. So, Chrissy, how do you feel about this? Are you happy that Christopher McQuarrie is coming back, or are you sad that we're not going to get to see someone else's vision?
I am both. I do think that it's kind of a bummer to break a streak like that, you know, where you sort of have to ask yourself, well, wasn't the intention to always be bringing a fresh perspective to this? So I see your point for sure. But I'm also excited that he's coming back. I liked this movie a lot. I liked his take on it. I'm excited to see what he's going to do with another Ethan Hunt story and where he's going to take it from here. So I would say, like, on the whole, I'm glad about it. I'm glad. It's maybe also a bummer for the next director who won't be getting the opportunity. But I'm confident that I'm going to like what I see.
Yeah.
All right. What about you, John?
Well, okay. I think that the Mission Impossible movies, the closest analog, whatever, is like James Bond. Okay. Ethan Hunt is essentially James Bond in this series. And so Bond has had a bunch of different directors. However, whenever they found somebody who was able to get the job done and do something really well, you know, communicate a story really well and bring something to Bond that they felt elevated it, they would stick with that director. Sometimes it can go wrong. And you know, you wind up with, you know, some messes along the way. But I think that in this case, it's very much worth the gamble, especially because I think it's possible that they're viewing 5 and 6 like a duology, because 5 very much feels like a setup to make the Impossible Missions Force, you know, a legit organization. Because, you know, like we were joking about, I think, you know, shortly before, you know, they're going to be avowed this time. Like, you have Alec Baldwin is installed as the director at the beginning, and you know you have William Brandt, who's going to be his right hand man, who can communicate with Ethan and go out to the field when he needs to. It feels like this is set up for the next story with this team. And so I'm okay with it, because I think that the director coming back will provide that continuity. And then maybe he, you know, then it's a pass off the torch for the 7th one, because he's done his job to get the story up to this point. That's just my take on it.
Okay. Before I give my take on it, I mean, just one thing that you were talking about, you know, the James Bond movies or whatever. And I know, Chrissy, you mentioned, something about how these movies, these last 2 movies are sort of connected in a way or similar to what's going on with the James Bond franchise.
With James Bond. Yeah, it's something that I'm not as big a Bond fan, I have to admit. I enjoy Bond, but I don't like just run to it the way I run to a Mission Impossible. But I have noticed in watching the last several Bond movies that have come out pretty close to Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, that there were so many similarities that I find myself getting confused sometimes when I'm trying to remember which thing happened in which movie. I think there's a scene in Rogue Nation where Alec Baldwin is basically saying that the Impossible Missions Force is a throwback to a bygone era where agents operated without oversight, and the world has moved on to the point where we no longer need an Ethan Hunt out there doing whatever he feels is best. I think that Ralph Fiennes has almost that exact speech in either Skyfall or Spectre.
Skyfall.
Where he's like, yeah, the world no longer needs Bond. We don't need 00s anymore. And for exactly the same reason, we've moved on and you're a relic from the past. So they're the kind of the plots maybe are a little bit similar to me, which I don't want to say that I don't love it, but it is a little bit like, oh, okay. So, oh, somebody's got a list of all the agents' names. They should stop making those lists, by the way. Like, stop putting all the agents' names on a list. You know, and Ethan Hunt is always disavowed, as we said, but it seems like Bond is always also, like, not allowed to be part of the team. Then they also had an element introduced in the last several films, which I really love, which is this idea of Ethan Hunt and James Bond throughout the course of the stories, like, getting hurt and being tired. Mm-hmm. And sort of just sometimes shaking their heads and being like, are you serious right now? You want me to do what? And I think in both Skyfall and in Ghost Protocols, we sort of see the introduction of that, where, you know, their team members and the people who are getting all the stuff together for them is like, okay, and then you're going to run up the side of this building with these special gloves that are made of glue, and then you're just going to hop on back. And, you know, or hold your breath for 4 minutes while you do all this complicated technical stuff. And, watch out for the spinning arms of death. And, oh, yeah, also, I'm going to get killed if you screw up. Have fun, Ethan. Like, I think Simon Pegg even says to him, like, oh, he's fine. Don't worry about him. He's good. He's Ethan Hunt. And Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt sort of gets those moments of, like, seriously? You want me to what? Didn't I just do a thing? Like, I already did something today. And then you see that in Bond too, like in particular in Skyfall, where he's getting hurt and he's like tired and winded, and you know, I think the villain says to him, like, do we really have to do this, all this running around? Are you sure this is the way we're gonna solve it? So, you know, I think in both of those sort of plot and in this kind of new way to see the hero as being like a human being who's infinitely capable, but also like still wants to take a nap at the end of the day. mm-hmm. Kind of happens in both.
Now, see, now you've intrigued me to the point where I want to go back and I want to do double features of Mission Impossible with the Bond that came out closest to them to see how much the series has been informed.
There's actually, I mean, because especially with these last two now, they involve like a secret society of agents and there are some people who are actually saying, like, because, you know, this movie was originally supposed to come out at Christmas, going head to head with Star Wars, which would have ended fantastically for Mission Impossible, I'm sure, and they moved the release date up to July, and a lot of people were speculating that maybe the reason was because, you know, people were starting to realize that it has the exact same plot as Spectre, you know, in a lot of ways. And maybe they were trying to distance themselves so as to avoid the comparison. Although I think at the time, there are a lot of people who are thinking that Spectre would be the superior movie, and the general reaction ended up going in Mission Impossible's favor. But, you know,
as a diehard Bond fan, I'm forced to agree with it. Mission Impossible 5 was superior. Now, I truly did enjoy Spectre a lot, but yeah, Mission Impossible 5, I feel, was more successful in a number of areas.
Fair enough. I personally think that Spectre was better in this instance, but, you know. But I thought Mission Impossible 3 was better than Casino Royale, so it all balances out, okay?
I guess so, in the great ledger.
All right. So for me, just because I've said this a million times in a million places, but I'll say it again once more for the record. You know, I am violently opposed to Christopher McQuarrie coming back to direct Mission Impossible 6. I don't care if this is the Citizen Kane of the Mission Impossible movies. You know, the idea that they're bringing someone who has made one before back to do another one suggests to me that this was never their master plan. It was just a happy coincidence. And at some point, just like they never, I'm sure, planned to have him, you know, jump and land, you know, a few inches from the ground in every single movie. Which, does he do that here or not? Does he do that? I don't think he does.
You mean a couple inches from the edge? Well, he jumps on a plane wing, which is pretty...
He doesn't do that, does he?
No.
Or he's sort of suspended in the air?
Like, you know, like in the first movie, yeah, he falls, and then like right before he hits the ground. And then they do it in all the other movies. You know, Jeremy Renner does it in the last one, right, on top of the magnet thingy. I don't think they do it in this one. That's strange. But anyway, just like that was never planned out, you know, and at some point it became like a joke, it became a gag or whatever. I mean, they should have realized. They should have realized what they had going here, and they should have hired someone else, like Paul Thomas Anderson, to direct this one.
Not Soderbergh? You don't want to hire Steven Soderbergh?
I think Paul Thomas Anderson would have made more sense since they have the history together, right? But, I mean, I would have totally watched Soderbergh's Mission Impossible. But
he could have broken the sixth wall.
He could have, and he probably would have, and it would have been amazing. Yeah. But he made his Mission Impossible movie. Haywire. Did you guys see Haywire?
No.
With Gina Carano? Oh, man. If you want to see a good, again, like Way of the Gun, like super realistic, like action movie about a spy. I mean, it is Mission Impossible. It's basically Mission Impossible.
Oh, that's okay. No, I know the movie you're talking about. I haven't seen it. I do want to see it. Yeah.
With Gina Carano as the spy. And, you know, it's awesome. It's extremely good. You know, she's obviously, you know, capable of doing all of her own stunts and everything.
Yeah,
so,
legit
and,
fighter. Yeah.
Yeah, and all of the combat and everything is like super realistic. And it would be like if Steven Soderbergh were to make a Mission Impossible movie. It's the best. Check it out for sure.
Okay, then.
But no, Paul Thomas Anderson, that should have been who they got. Anyway, whatever.
Silly me.
I'll settle for for Christopher McQuarrie. I'll still watch the movie. Whatever. Okay, so... I guess just one last thing here, which I know that we've talked about numerous times, but I just feel the need to say it again. Since we're talking about, you know, these movies in relation to Star Trek Beyond and looking at them as sort of J.J. Abrams productions and what that means for Star Trek Beyond, you know, this movie played an integral role in the creation of Star Trek Beyond in that this was the Bad Robot production which was going on when things seemed to be in trouble behind the scenes on Star Trek Beyond. And in some discussions that Brian Burke, the other producer, was having with Simon Pegg, who obviously is going to be acting in the new Star Trek movie, on the set of this movie, Simon Pegg gave some suggestions to Brian Burke as to directions which they might want to go in with Star Trek Beyond. And Brian Burke apparently liked those directions a lot and decided to hire Pegg to write Star Trek Beyond. So without this movie, Star Trek Beyond would not be the movie which it will be, good or bad.
And probably not released on time either.
Probably not.
Mm. Yeah.
So there you go. Any final thoughts on Rogue Nation, Chrissy?
Oh, final thoughts on Rogue Nation. I love it. It's really great. I love. We didn't talk at all about Simon Pegg. We talked a lot about Alec Baldwin.
Oh yeah, I guess we should.
We didn't talk about Simon Pegg in this. And I love what he brings to the Rogue Nation table. You know, in the Ghost Protocol, and when we. Mutant Man 3, I love the idea that he thought for a moment that he had won tickets to an opera in Vienna. He was just like, oh, I'll nip off and see an opera.
Yeah.
That's nothing unusual there. I love how loyal he is to Ethan, of course. And I love that he's the guy who is always, he's writing checks that Ethan Hunt is expected to cash. I'm excited to know that he contributed to Beyond, because to me that means that, you know, A, that they knew it was in trouble and needed to do something, and that, you know, Simon Pegg is going to be the guy who's like, what if we try this? Because I think he's so creative and, you know, has made so many interesting things that, like, I'm willing to bet that his contribution is going to be wholly beneficial.
Yeah, yeah. What they do with his character, the character of Benji, and Benji's arc mm-hmm. sort of over these three movies is pretty awesome, because he really does just start as sort of like the comic relief computer nerd guy sitting, you know, at the office doing his thing. And then they bring him into the field, change the dynamic. And then with this one, I mean, he gets to some dark places, you know. I mean, that scene where he's like being held captive and the big bad guy mm-hmm. who looks terrifying is, you know, face to face with him. I'm like, wow, you know, we've come so far with this character, from the guy who is just sort of the nerdy dude in the computer room to now going head to head with this big bad guy. I mean, that's pretty impressive, mm-hmm. you know, the way that they were able to successfully build that character into what he is in this movie. So, yeah, it's definitely cool for sure. What about you, John? Any final thoughts?
I don't know how much more praise I could throw on it, except for the fact that I call me blasphemous for saying this or whatever, but Joe Kramer, I liked this soundtrack more than what Giacchino did in Mission Impossible 4. I actually, at several points, I was like, yeah, I dig this. This is what I want to hear. And as a tie to another movie that we have spoken about while talking about J.J. Abrams as producer, he did the score for Joyride 2, which was not produced by Abrams, but was based on characters that were co-created by Abrams. So it's a tenuous connection, but it's there.
Yeah. I mean, I liked Joe Kramer's work on this for sure, but, I mean, Giacchino was on fire in 3 and 4, so, you know, I don't know. I can't do that. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I do like this movie now. I appreciate it much more than I did the first time I saw it. I think maybe my expectations were so high that when it didn't do exactly what I wanted it to do the first time around, I was disappointed. But now, looking at it again for what it is and not what I want it to be, I can appreciate it a lot more. And I'm anxiously looking forward to watching it again, because I imagine that I'm going to like it even more the next time around. So, yeah.
Cool.
All right. So, Chrissy, now I know you're on Educating Geeks, and people can find you on there. Is there anything else you want to plug, or anywhere else people can find you?
Well, yes, folks who live in the Phoenix area or the greater Phoenix area can find me at National Comedy Theater every Friday and Saturday night, where we do improvised comedy shows and teach improv classes. And that's nctphoenix.com.
nctphoenix.com. Awesome.
Yes, it's N for National, C for Comedy, T for Theater, and then Phoenix, all spelled out, .com.
Excellent.
Nice. Very cool.
That's kind of a dream job, I'm not going to lie. It's kind of awesome.
It is definitely a dream job, for sure. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Very cool. Very cool. If Mike and I come out to Phoenix, we're getting comp tickets, right?
Oh, absolutely. You'll be the guest of honor.
Yes.
We'll drag you up on stage.
Let's plan this trip, Mike.
All right. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been really great. And yeah, you're welcome back anytime.
Woohoo!
Well, that was fun talking to Chrissy about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. And yeah, it's a good conversation.
Yeah, very good.
So, there's some news, some creator news, some big creator news.
About
in the
Star
world
Trek?
Yeah. Huh. I know, right?
I didn't see anybody talking about anything. What's it about?
It's about the showrunner and co-creator of the new Star Trek series. Now, I know that we're late to the party because, of course, this happened the day after we recorded our last show. So we're like, you know, a week and a half behind here. But, you know, whatever. It is what it is. Brian Fuller has been hired to co-create and run the new Star Trek show.
Yes.
Now, Brian Fuller, for those people who may not be familiar, is a Star Trek writer. He got his start on Deep Space Nine. There was the open submission program, which we talked to Eric about and everything when on Next Generation, and that continued through Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And Brian Fuller submitted some scripts to the various shows, and Deep Space Nine bought a couple of them and turned them into some episodes, which included his first episode, The Darkness and the Light, which now every time I see the title, all I can think of is, what's his name?
Yeah,
Snoke.
Snoke, yeah.
Yeah, so he did that one, and then he did another one, M'Pok Noor, for Deep Space Nine. He did the stories for those, and then he got a job on Voyager and worked his way onto the staff and worked his way all the way up to, you know, a co-producer by the time that show ended, and wrote a lot of episodes, which are considered to be really good, like Living Witness and Workforce. And his final episode was Friendship One, which was one of the last episodes of Voyager. And he has in the past talked about how his dream job would be to run the new Star Trek show, or a new Star Trek show. He's been talking about this for at least 3 years now, you know, talking about how he had an idea for like a second ship in the JJ verse. He said perhaps the Reliant, talking about how he and Brian Singer had a pitch for an idea, and he was expecting it, you know, to or expecting them to talk about it after Into Darkness was released, and now finally here he is. It's, I think, the thing that everyone kind of hoped and dreamed for, because he started off in Star Trek, and once he left Star Trek, he became a name, and now he wants to come back to Star Trek, and it's kind of awesome that this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, and he's not just a name because he's been like sticking around. He's made some stuff that has really made an impression. I mean, I was a big fan of the show Hannibal, and that show created an impression for two reasons. One, it was really well written and acted and produced, but two, it was like, the perspective I'm coming from is I'm truly excited to see what he does with Star Trek, because Hannibal was the type of show where, not just in terms of the limits it pushed, but in terms of the look it had, that I would watch it and say, I cannot believe I'm watching network television. Like it was on network television, and its visual aesthetic was meeting and or exceeding shows that are acclaimed on FX and AMC and these other basic cable channels that have frequently gotten away with, you know, just a slicker look to create the impression. So I think that there's no downside to this announcement. There's no downside to this hire. I don't see anybody that could possibly come at this and say, oh, Brian Fuller, like I'm stoked. Even if I didn't know that he was coming home to Star Trek, if all I knew was that he produced Hannibal, I'd be like, oh, yes, awesome. And I think that all, you know, the stuff that he's worked on is always, you know, it hasn't been necessarily long lived. And, you know, he's sort of, I guess, known in some ways for his shows sort of getting killed before their time. But it's not because his shows were bad. It's because they weren't getting ratings that the networks wanted. And so now he's being put in an environment with a property that has incredible potential where he's not going to have to worry about ratings. Not traditional ratings the way that he's always had to. Like, he's able to create a show where CBS is going to be like, hey, are we making money on the app? Yeah. Okay, cool. You know?
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. You know, I'm ashamed to say that I haven't watched any of Brian Fuller's creations up until now, which is really weird. I mean, obviously, I've seen his Star Trek stuff, and I saw his work on Heroes, which honestly, I thought that show was a piece of crap. But regardless, I mean, that wasn't
it was
like
overrated,
his show.
But the it time was, he was yeah. there was one of its stronger moments.
That's terrifying. But, you know, it's one of those things where, like, it's never like I was like, I don't want to watch that show. It was always like, oh, I want to watch that show. I just, I don't have the time, you know, but sooner mm-hmm. or later I will get around to watching it. And now is the sooner or the later, you know, it's now is the time. So when this happened, when this announcement made, you know, especially since like we do this show, like I kind of freaked out a little bit since I didn't, everyone's like, Brian Fuller is amazing. And I'm like, I'm sure you're right, but I haven't seen this stuff, you know? It's like, so I went back, and this week I have watched every single Brian Fuller pilot with the exception of Hannibal, because I ran out of time, but I will watch it. So I've liked all of them to one degree or another. I mean, just to go down the list, it's Dead Like Me, mm-hmm. which I thought was really good. Have you seen that one?
Long ago, yeah.
Okay, yeah, really cool.
I haven't revisited anything.
He only did the first five episodes, and then he left because the network was, like, completely screwing him over. But, yeah, regardless. Then he did Wonderfalls, which is also a very interesting show, which got canceled after four episodes. I love the DVD. It's like the complete series, all 13 episodes, including nine, which never aired before.
Yeah,
like,
which never made it to air. Yeah.
Oh, boy. But it's. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen it. It was gone too quick.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, just so the people, Dead Like Me is a show about a girl, like an 18-year-old girl who dies and becomes a Grim Reaper. But it's a comedy. You know, it's done for laughs. Mm-hmm. It's good. Wonderfalls, very similar concept. It's about like this girl who she graduates from college and now she's working in a gift shop at Niagara Falls, and she's having sort of like a crisis of you know, her life or whatever, trying to figure out what it is that she's doing with her life. And then little inanimate objects, like for example a wax lion or an eagle on the back of a quarter, start talking to her and saying, hey, you should do these things. And basically what they're telling her to do is things which will end up helping other people.
Oh, that's right? Cool.
It's really weird, but awesome. I really liked the first episode. Definitely check it out. It's very funny. Then he did The Amazing Screw-On Head, which I had seen before. Seen that before. Have you seen that?
Nope. I haven't seen that one.
It's based on a Mike Mignola comic book, the guy who does Hellboy.
Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Okay. I know, it's weird, right? But yeah, he did this comic book, and basically what it is it takes place like during like Civil War era, and there's a guy voiced mm-hmm. by Paul Giamatti, and he's a head that screws on to whatever bodies he needs to be screwed onto. And he's basically like Abraham Lincoln's James Bond. So anytime Lincoln needs something done, whether it's fighting like zombies or whatever, he sends in the Amazing Screw-On Head who saves the day.
Yeah.
And it's got Paul Giamatti, David Hyde Pierce, you know, it's all done. Like Mignola himself was the art director. So it looks like that style.
Oh, wow. See, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Okay. And they did the one episode, you know, animated for the Sci-Fi Channel, and it didn't get picked up, so they just showed it as like a special, but you can
now,
find
was
it.
Now, was it when it was the Sci-Fi Channel or the Sci-Fi Channel?
It was back when it was spelled properly.
Okay, that's good.
Yes. So I had seen that before, and it is good. It's really funny, you know. So there's that. And then he did Pushing Daisies, which mm-hmm. I think most people consider to be his masterpiece in a sense. He got nominated for Emmys for that one and stuff, which is about a guy who can bring things back to life for 1 minute unless he touch. It's very complicated. But he's a pie maker, very quirky. Barry Sonnenfeld, the guy who directed Get Shorty and Men in Black, did the pilot. You know, he won the Emmy for his direction. Super quirky, super weird. And honestly, just watching the pilots, while I did like it, that's the one that worked the least for me.
Interesting.
It was just a little too much. Like, I feel like both Sonnenfeld and Fuller are super crazy guys, and when you put them together, there's no one to tell them when to stop, you know? So, I don't know. Whatever.
I wouldn't agree with you about Pushing Daisies. That one I have seen. I haven't revisited it, but I have very fond memories of it. But the thing is, to touch on the crazy ideas thing, like, he's the type of creative guy you want running this Star Trek show, because if there's one thing you can sort of ping, and, you know, on From There to Here, we're rewatching everything. And one of the points that's already come back is, well, you know, when you have this many hours of television, you're going to revisit some things. You're going to redo some things. And I think that if you just look at the body, if you just look at Pushing Daisies, like, you have somebody coming in who's going to say, no, let's be a little nuts. Let's be a little crazy with it and breathe some life into it. Let's not just stay beholden to the idea that it's Star Trek and it has to be sci-fi in this mold. Like, I think that he could actually sort of blow the doors off of it and take
it somewhere.
That's
definitely true. Yeah. And he's definitely got a really good sense of humor. He's really good with dialogue and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, I guess I've only seen one episode of Pushing Daisies, so I can imagine, you know, that it would grow into something, you know, much bigger and better or whatever. And I'll definitely check it out for sure.
Yeah, I think.
And then the last one that I watched was Mockingbird Lane, which was his failed Munsters reboot that he did with Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
You didn't like it? See, I was like, hey, I was like, this is a really weird, interesting, cool take. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I grew up watching the Munsters, and I appreciated this take. I'm not like a super Munster fan or anything like that, but I was like, yeah, I'm down with this. I could watch this show for
sure. It didn't click with me. It just didn't click.
All right. So, yeah, so the show is, just to recap, if anyone wants to check them out or whatever, and, you know, it is Dead Like Me, Wonder Falls, The Amazing Screw on Head, Pushing Daisies,
yeah,
Mockingbird Lane, and Hannibal. I need to check out Hannibal. Next week I'll let you know what I think about the
Hannibal
the
will wear you out. I'm going to warn you, it will wear you out. It was one of those shows where, you know how everybody loves to marathon stuff? Mm-hmm. I couldn't marathon Hannibal. Like, at the end of an hour, you're kind of like, I need a break, guys. I need to walk away from this and sort of, I have to go look at a sunrise or something.
Yeah.
It goes some dark places.
And he's got a new show coming out, too, American Gods, based on the Neil Gaiman book. So that should be exciting, too. So,
yeah.
So exciting times in the world of Star Trek. Yes, for sure. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation and Brian Fuller this week. But that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
Geordi is the one that's like, you know what? No, you're wrong. You're wrong about Data.
I'm going to drop a challenge right here, and Data's totally going to step up to the plate, and you're going to get served, Plasky.
And that's how LaForge created Moriarty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it turned out good, but I mean, he had good intentions.
The Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
Is there any redeeming value?
The Ready Room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet saying, she stayed at her post.
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
It feels like I just won an Oscar and an Emmy and a Tony. All at the same time, and a People's Choice Award, and a Nickelodeon Award.
Dang!
So,
not quite an EGOT, but close. Commentary, Trek Stars.
I haven't seen Mean Girls.
You haven't seen Mean Girls.
I know, everybody wants me to see Mean Girls.
Oh my God. Yeah, you have to see Mean Girls. I mean, Right after Josie and the Pussycats, though.
Oh, how could I forget Josie and the Pussycats?
The 602 Club.
I actually like when they bring in the big container for the brain fish at the beginning.
That's so weird.
Yeah, and it really
opens
mysterious.
Up and it's, you know, speaking through the...
And all the minions that have to mop up after it at the end.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
Although it's like a slug trail.
You can actually see one of the guys while he's talking kind of wandering around mopping up. I was like, what is that guy doing?
Literary Treks.
You're totally right that when Atonement was done, I really did feel like everybody needed a break.
Like a Kit Kat bar?
There wouldn't be challenges and obstacles and things, but I wanted the next sort of series of adventures that they faced for a while to be more infused with the sense of wonder that sort of underpins all of Trek.
Women at Warp.
AF, which are the initials that Picard carved into Boothby's tree back on Starfleet Academy, and that is how he met Boothby the groundskeeper.
Well, we never did learn Boothby's first and second name, did we? It was all a ploy to get to hang out with Boothby.
Meta Treks.
If I look at the Abramsverse now, having talked it out, it seems like they're both an alternate timeline and an alternate reality at the same time. Not every sense of alternate timeline, not every sense of alternate reality, but there's at least one sense in which they overlap, and you can say you can have your cake and eat it too, and the Abramsverse is both at the same time.
Melodic Treks.
I wanted something for the cars, you know, a phrase describing them, which is amazing. And I wanted to use a different word for that, for amazing. And in this case, I sought out the African Swahili word, Kushengeza, which is an actual word that means amazing.
And introducing Saturday Morning Trek, a show about the animated series and all things Trek in the 1970s.
Chekhov was in the first season, but he was working on the third deck behind the boiler room and was ill with a condition called Malaprovsky's malady, which is a kind of 23rd century version of Montezuma's revenge, and was hidden in the bathroom, ensconced there for hours and hours, while poor Mr. Khan's genetically engineered kidneys about to explode pounded pitifully on the door, begging to be let in, until finally the door opens, Chekhov steps out, Khan looks at him and says, "Your face, I remember."
That's the best explanation I've ever heard.
You get the idea that I've told this story before.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. You can find us anywhere you get your podcasts, including iTunes, Windows Phone, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Media Player, all those places.
Yes.
You can stream and download them from the website. You know, if you just go to Trek.fm, you can find them all there. So check it out. And while you're at iTunes, leave us a review. You know, it'll make us happy. We will read it on the air. In a silly voice. If you want to contact us, you can go to trek.fm/contact and fill out the form there, which will go directly to us. Or you can find the network on Facebook. Just look for Trek.fm, or you can find the network on Twitter at Trek.fm, or also on Facebook, you can find the Babel Conference, which is our listener discussion group, is basically our forums, you know, where we talk about whatever we want to talk about. You know, there was an interesting Rogue Nation thread, which spinned into a discussion as to whether or not Mad Max Fury Road was any good, you know? So, hey.
Spoilers, it is.
Yeah, I agree with you. High five.
High five.
All right. Virtual high five. So you can find us in all of those locations. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. You can find me on another podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my buddy Craig, where we talk about all of the effluvia of science fiction and other geekery. And you can find me on a podcast called Aggressive Negotiations that I co-host with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing, where we explore some of the weirder corners of the Star Wars galaxy.
Yeah, did you see in that press release today, they announced that Michael Kaplan is coming back to do costumes for Episode 8?
That's fantastic.
We're going to get some more awesome jackets.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I was most heartened by just that. I got to be honest, that footage of Luke was great to see again.
So you think that was new footage or not? Because there's people who are like, his beard is different and all this stuff. And
I think that's just what they shot for, because Johnson was there helping shoot the end, what became the end of episode 7.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, he actually worked with Abrams on that one.
Cool.
So, I mean, who knows if that means that we're going to open with like an alternate take of the ending of episode 7 and it'll be like instantaneously afterward. Be interesting.
You got to figure that it's got to start in space somehow.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they broke, you know, other quote unquote rules of the Star Wars visual language before. So while I would desperately want them to start with a ship in space just for the sake of repetition, I think I've learned to sort of let go and just be like, you know what? They're going to do whatever they do.
True enough. And Laura Dern, hey man, Laura Dern from The Master, right?
Yeah, you know, I actually, I was trying to think, would she play Winter, who's an old EU character who had a perfect memory and was able to, you know, she was basically like Leia's, right hand or whatever in the Zahn novels, but in the original ones back in the 90s. But my wife actually said, oh, well, she could be Rey's mom. I was like, oh, yeah, actually she could. Yeah.
I think that's where the good money is right now. Everyone's talking about, yeah, she's going to be Rey's mom. I don't know. Yeah. Exciting times.
Yes,
for sure.
Exciting times. Where can they find you though, Mike?
You can find me right here on Trek FM doing From There to Here, producing it each and every day. And you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Track Stars, and you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. You can find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars, and you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. All right, before we go, buy some of our stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Go to Trek.fm/store, and that'll take you to our Redbubble store where you can get hoodies or t-shirts or pillows or whatever else you want. Some good stuff on there, for sure.
Some really cool stuff. Really cool stuff.
And I hear there's more designs coming soon. Still hoping for a Citizen Kane of podcasts thing, but you know, we'll see how that goes. Another way that you can help us out is by becoming a patron of the network on patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm, where you can donate on a monthly basis to help keep the show running. And there's different perks based on how much you donate, whether it's wallpapers or early downloads or seats on our content development team, or participating in the Patron Roundtable podcast. You know, there's exciting stuff. It definitely some good stuff which you can do, and we would really appreciate your support for sure. And one last way that you can help us out is by supporting our sponsor, Audible.com, where you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for signing up, along with a 30-day trial to see how great Audible is. John, you got a book for us this week?
Do I ever. Since there was a sly reference to it in Rogue Nation, this week it's Battlefield Earth, written by L. Ron Hubbard, narrated by Roddy McDowell. Suspense, politics, war, humor, and intergalactic finance. A towering masterwork of science fiction adventure and one of the best-selling science fiction novels of all time, L. Ron Hubbard's Battlefield Earth opens with breathtaking scope on an Earth dominated for 1,000 years by an alien invader, and man is an endangered species. From the handful of surviving humans, a courageous leader emerges, Johnny Good Boy Tyler, who challenges the invincible might of the alien Cyclo Empire in a battle of epic scale, danger, and intrigue with the fate of the Earth and of the universe in the tenuous balance.
You know, I just thought about this. I'm going to get to see The Master in 70mm next week, and I think maybe before that I have to watch Battlefield Earth for the first time at home, do a good double feature.
Don't watch. No, don't watch. No, there's no there is no legitimate reason to watch Battlefield Earth. Go to Audible and download the book. The book I have read, the book is actually quite enjoyable until about the last 100 pages. But it is a good book.
Okay.
Way better than the movie.
Okay. I'll download the book and I'll listen to it while I'm driving to the theater.
There you go.
And since I'm a listener to Trek FM, I can get that book or any other book of my choice for free if I go to audibletrial.com/trekfm. That's audibletrial.com/trekfm. I can sign up, get a free audiobook, get the free trial, see how great it is, and yeah, everyone's happy. All right. I guess that's pretty much it. Rogue Nation. We talked about Brian Fuller. And that's it for J.J. Abrams in terms of the movies that we're covering.
Yeah.
So next week we're going to do a recap where we're going to look at all of these movies as a whole and see what conclusions we can draw about his contribution to Star Trek Beyond.